American taxpayers would be better served if federal funds were distributed directly to the state of Alaska or to Alaskan communities.
Another congressional effort to defund the Denali Commission. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, making the case for using more wind power in Fairbanks.
The bottom line is, if you can displace diesel with wind, you've saved money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
In Congress this week, the Denali Commission survived another attempt to strip it of federal funds. APRN's Liz Ruskin has the story about what's become something of a ritual in the U.S. House.
Fiscal conservatives are gunning for the Denali Commission and this week tried to eliminate the bulk of its funding, $10 million tucked into a federal appropriations bill for energy and water programs. Ohio Congressman Steve Chabot argued, as others have for years, the Denali Commission is an unnecessary middleman.
American taxpayers would be better served if federal funds were distributed directly to the state of Alaska or to Alaskan communities.
Chabot has a separate bill to kill the Denali Commission altogether, which is officially called the Eliminate the Commission to Nowhere Act. Alaska Congressman Don Young, though, argues the Denali Commission provides more direct service because it cuts government agencies out of the picture.
It's money well spent. If we don't spend it on this type of thing, to cut out the middlemen, they keep saying there's other agencies. This is not true. Those agencies do not function.
The commission is a relic of Alaska's big money days. Senator Ted Stevens created it in 1998 to spur rural development. He modeled it after the poverty-busting Appalachian Regional Commission. But that commission coordinates projects across multiple states. The Denali Commission serves only Alaska. A slew of auditors and watchdogs have claimed it does work the state could do for itself. Oklahoma Congressman James Lankford picked up those arguments this week.
We as a nation have to find ways to be able to eliminate duplication, and this is one of those moments. Are we going to listen to the Inspector General, Congressional Budget Office, GAO, two different presidents, Office of Management and Budgets, or will we ignore all of those?
Young reminded his colleagues that dozens of Alaska villages lack running water and other infrastructure their constituents take for granted. He says the Denali Commission is doing its job.
It's time we accept the fact this system works as the other commissions do for those communities that are less fortunate than those communities that most people live in this body.
The amendment to cut $10 million from the Denali Commission failed by a substantial margin. Young was one of 69 Republicans who joined most of the Democrats in voting no. The Denali Commission these days focuses mostly on bulk fuel storage and other energy projects. It expects a total budget of $14 million next year. At its peak in 2006, its budget was $140 million. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A Fairbanks-based alternative energy company continues to push Golden Valley Electric Association to buy more of its wind power. Alaska Environmental Power operates a wind farm in Delta Junction and recently teamed with an Anchorage law firm on a report it hopes will sway utility members. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The white paper shows Golden Valley Electric Association residential rates going up about 50% since 2006 and predicts future hikes as oil and natural gas prices rise and regulation of coal-fired power plants tightens. Alaska Environmental Power managing partner Mike Kraft believes more wind energy is part of a solution.
The bottom line is, if you can displace diesel with wind, you've saved money.
Golden Valley Electric currently buys 2 megawatts of power from AEP's Delta Wind Farm and generates a bunch more from its own wind project at Healy. But most of the co-op's power is either locally generated from coal and oil-fired plants or purchased over the intertie from Anchorage-based natural gas-fired producers. Kraft would like to expand AEP's Delta Wind Farm and sell the co-op 24 megawatts under a long-term contract. He maintains GVEA could simply idle back its oil-fired generators in North Pole when it's windy in Delta.
I will be the first to admit that wind does not blow 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. However, if the wind resource is as strong as the one is in Delta, it's a fairly easy proposition to integrate that wind power. As the wind power becomes available, basically you turn the throttle down at North Pole. It's not rocket science.
Kraft and Golden Valley have gone back and forth over Alaska Environmental Power's proposal. GVEA President and CEO Corey Borgeson disputes Kraft's slam dunk characterization of savings, pointing to the inefficiency of backing up wind with oil-fired generators, something he likens to lead-foot driving.
It's like pushing the accelerator and pulling it off and pushing the accelerator and pulling it off on a car. Your gas mileage goes down dramatically, and that happens as well with our power plants.
Borgeson says Golden Valley uses the North Pole oil turbines to back up wind energy because they can be adjusted quickly. He says GVEA has done modeling to figure out how much wind it can use without washing out the savings with oil backup.
The more wind you have, the bigger the engine you have to have going. And it may take two turbines, not just one. And you're going to have to throttle them up and back them down even more. And the other thing about throttling an engine up and backing it down and throttling up and backing it down is it wears out the engine.
Federal law requires utilities to buy energy from independent producers if it's at or below the cost of generating it themselves. But GVEA and Kraft don't agree on the numbers. Last year, Kraft turned to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Basically challenged the RCA to look at four different issues. One of them was the cost equation that Golden Valley was using for an avoided cost. The other was the fact that the utility wanted to curtail us at any point in time for any reason, which basically kills your finance package on a project. And there were a couple other caveats in there that we challenged.
The RCA has more than a year to rule on the case. State legislators have also looked at a bill to address the independent power producer situation. Short of outside direction, Golden Valley and Kraft could come to a resolution, something GVEA's Borgeson says the utility is open to.
There's good interest at Golden Valley for putting out as much wind power as possible and being as environmentally friendly as possible. We just don't want to do it on the backs of our ratepayers.
Borgeson points to one other factor affecting whether the utility enters into a long-term contract to buy more Delta wind: the future local availability of other power sources, including natural gas. That could happen via a state-supported North Slope trucking project. Kraft maintains the gas will be expensive and contribute to long-term rate increases. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
State Representative David Gutenberg wants to jumpstart Fairbanks' conversion to natural gas heating. The state is pursuing a public-private project to process North Slope gas and truck it to Fairbanks, but Gutenberg says it faces a familiar problem.
It's the old chicken and the egg. Which comes first? You can't get gas here until you have customers, and you're not going to have customers until you have gas here.
The Interior Energy Project calls for getting natural gas to Fairbanks at a consumer price equivalent to half the cost of heating oil. First gas is expected by 2016, with installation of distribution piping to neighborhoods taking some years longer. Gutenberg says the state can more immediately engage gas customers with a pilot program.
You subsidize the cost of the conversion. You subsidize the cost of putting a gas storage tank at their house, subsidize the cost of the gas to what it's going to be, and you deliver it.
Gutenberg says natural gas trucked in from Cook Inlet could meet demand of the Fairbanks pilot program until North Slope gas is available. He envisions a group of about 100 select households participating. Representative Gutenberg says he brought up the idea with Alaska Energy Authority officials and Interior Energy Project contractors that are in town this week for meetings. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau kids get a lesson in traveling in bear country.
I don't think I would be afraid of bears in a group, but like alone, if you're just walking through the woods alone, it might be a little bit scary.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Scattered rain showers are in the Fairbanks area forecast, and any precipitation that falls will add to local totals that have Fairbanks on track to continue breaking wet weather records. The last rain event on Monday, a thunderstorm that brought heavy downpours, boosted July precipitation even further above normal. The National Weather Service reports that Monday's thunderstorm dropped 1.13 inches at Fairbanks International, where the agency takes its official measurements. Meteorologist Ryan Metzger says the rain moved Fairbanks up the list of the city's rainiest Julys.
So far for the month of July, we've had 4.49 inches, and that's the fourth highest amount on record for the month of July. The wettest, for reference, is 5.96 inches, and that was set in 2003.
Metzger says Fairbanks normally receives 2.16 inches of rain in July. Fairbanks just logged its rainiest June, and the combined months of June and July have already bested the previous two-month high mark. Metzger says there is a chance of breaking the June, July, August record as well.
The record for a summer season is 11.59 inches. And so right now we're sitting at 8.05 inches. So we'd have to have a couple more big events for that to happen.
Metzger says nothing like that is currently in the forecast. Earlier this year, the University of Alaska Press released a book detailing a biologist's lifelong effort to chronicle the lives of wolves that live inside the boundary of Denali Park and Preserve. Mary Beth Holloman was a friend of Dr. Gordon Haber, who was killed in a plane crash in Denali in 2009. Holloman spent the last few years digging through 40 years' worth of Haber's field notes, journals, and even tweets. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, Holloman has compiled Haber's work into a new book.
Mary Beth Holloman first heard Gordon Haber talk about wolves in his research 30 years ago.
He just retained that sense of wonder about his subject that, you know, really makes other people light up about it. It really gets you excited about it, too. So that was my first memory of Gordon.
Holloman soon became friends with Haber. He's been described as cantankerous and prickly. He first came to Alaska in the 60s for the same reason many 20-somethings do, the wilderness. Later, he became an outspoken biologist, questioning the state's wildlife management methods. But Holloman says that's because he was also one of the few wolf experts in Alaska.
People don't like people who say things they don't want to hear. And Gordon had an unassailable experiential authority in wolf behavior and wolf family structure. So he drew some conclusions from his research, and a lot of people in Alaska don't want to hear them because it goes directly against the kind of predator control and wildlife management that goes on in the state.
Haber spent his career monitoring the wolf packs of Denali National Park and Preserve.
His primary conclusion was that you can't manage wolves by the numbers because the functional unit of a wolf isn't one wolf. It's a family group of wolves, that social group, that dynamic is what's the core. So if you just say, I've got to kill so many wolves, that's not really the way to manage them. The way to manage them is to look at that family structure and manage them that way.
Mary Beth Holloman's book outlines Gordon Haber's other discoveries. For example, why do wolves howl?
Wolves howl for a lot of reasons. Wolves howl to let each other know where they are. They also howl simply for the joy of it. Sometimes they would howl with the plane engine flying overhead as a sort of a resonance. And they also howl when in distress.
As an anthropologist might spend years chronicling the habits of a specific cultural group, Holloman says Haber spent countless hours in blinds, tracking wolves, chronicling everything from their social habits to how they eat.
Gordon talks about an old-timer who told him, he hated wolves because wolves would take down an animal and just eat out its guts and then leave it. He'd found all these loose, with the guts eaten out, the rest of the animal left. And Gordon said, what happens is wolves scavenge winter-killed moose, but the moose is frozen, and so then they wait and they come back later for the rest, unless they're disturbed by a human, which is what happened in that instance.
Holloman's book also includes stories from people who ran into Haber during his time as a biologist for the National Park Service, including one from mountain climber Johnny Johnson, whose food cache was buried in an avalanche in 1972. Haber had hamburgers and French fries dropped to Johnson's climbing team. Holloman also includes snippets from Haber's Twitter feed. Raw wild beauty at the den tonight, with the wolves howling a great chorus for me as rolling thunder from a passing storm shakes the valley. That's a tweet from Haber 4 months before his death.
He could write for a scientific audience very clearly. His research reports or articles in Conservation Biology and other journals, and he could write pretty astonishingly concise letters to, the board of game and other entities that he was communicating with. And then he could write for a general audience. His blog and these tweets really showed that.
Mary Beth Holloman's epilogue paints a dark picture for the future of Denali's wolf population. The Park Service has reported declining numbers in recent years, but biologists there maintain that trend isn't necessarily out of the ordinary. But the issue remains politicized. Environmental groups continued to clash with the Board of Game. In 2010, they set a 6-year moratorium on all proposals regarding the Denali area wolf population. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska Native leader Don Wright has died. He was 84 years old when he passed away on July 5th. Wright was instrumental in developing the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, signed by President Richard Nixon in 1971. Wright was leader of the Alaska Federation of Natives that year. Wright helped organize AFN during the 1960s and fought to get the best settlement possible for Alaska Natives. Wright and other Native leaders traveled to Washington, D.C. to lobby for the law, even though funds were scarce. Wright often used his own money for airfare and expenses, since AFN in its early days had no funds at all. Despite the odds, Wright was successful in getting Nixon administration backing for the settlement. ANCSA compensated Alaska Natives for loss of lands and established Alaska Native corporations with the right to select 44 million acres of land and appropriated $962.5 million to them. Wright was born in Nenana in 1929. He was a pilot and established his own air service. His construction company built airstrips and roads in the interior, including the first oil field camp at Prudhoe Bay. Wright's family says he was a champion for Alaska. His funeral will take place July 26th in Nenana.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Joaquin Palomino. This week on AK, Barrowware. For naturalist Steve Murley, bear education isn't just about staying alive. The way he sees it, knowing how to behave in bear country allows Alaskans to explore wilderness more deeply. Murley works with Discovery Southeast, a Juneau organization that connects kids with nature programs. Earlier this month, KTOO's Lisa Fu joined campers for a lesson that had some questioning their assumptions about bear encounters.
In some comics, like Tundra, it shows bears like they just go up to a campsite and eat the person.
I have not heard any show that says bears are good in any way.
Part of Steve Murley's job is to change these sorts of perceptions. He tells the campers more people are attacked by dogs than bears. He also says a bear has never been documented harming a person that's in a group of five or more.
So we're already in a good spot. If a bear passes by, we're already in a group. And a bear's not going to go, that one looks tasty. It's not going to do that to us. Just going to go, whoa, there's a lot of humans. I'm out of here.
But he also reminds them.
There's lots of bears that live around here. So every time you're outside of a building, a school, your house, you're in bear country.
Murley moved to Juneau in 1981. He's been an educator for Discovery Southeast for 25 years. During the school year, he brings elementary students outside into nature. He teaches them how to identify landforms, animal tracks, and creatures that live in the water. In the summer, he joins the campers on hikes and talks about bears. He's excited to take them beyond the beaten Auk Lake Trail. Murley picks a spot and heads right, up a steep hill.
When we go off trail, it always kind of wakes up something inside me. Like I become more focused because I don't know what's on the other side of the hill.
The campers follow, walking through a thick growth of ferns and moss and lots of
devil's claw.
You're just going to dance with the devil's claw.
Dancing with devil's claw.
Murley gathers the campers in one spot and points to an imaginary bear about 100 yards away.
So I'm coming up the hill and I look up and there's a bear over there. And the first thing you're going to do, I'm going to do, is I'm just going to stop.
The next step is to assess the situation.
Does that bear know I'm here? And by and large, if it's that close, that bear probably knows I'm here. So I'm going to have a conversation with it.
Murley doesn't suggest raising your voice and looking big and scary, but to simply talk with the bear.
Oh, yeah, I was just coming up this hill, bear, and I was just like, I know I'm in your living room, and I'm just going to check out going back down the way I came because this is your place.
Murley tells the campers to keep talking like this as you slowly back away. The bear could stay where it is or move away itself. 12-year-old Landon Jung learned a different way to deal with bears from his grandfather.
To scare away the bear by acting big and making the bear not want to go around you or mess with you.
After taking turns role-playing bear and hiker, practicing Murley's method, both Landon and 12-year-old Brooke Sanford prefer it.
I think it was a good way because you were avoiding the bear, you weren't going towards it or scaring it away.
Brooke has seen bears before. She's mostly not afraid, but admits there are times she might be.
I don't think I would be afraid of bears in a group, but like alone, if you're just walking through the woods alone, might be a little bit scary.
Landon offers this advice.
Bears are more afraid of you than you are of them.
Murley says having a conversation with the bear allows it to know where you are.
The average encounter with a bear is one of proximity and orientation. So all I'm doing is allowing the bear to orient to me. And if I'm all feisty over there, right, the bear may orient to me more aggressively. And I've never tested that.
Murley spends a lot of his time outdoors, often exploring Juneau's mountains, cutting down firewood, or hunting for food. Like other adventurous Alaskans, he can't even count the times he's encountered bears.
So many.
In all that time, he's only had one encounter that didn't go so well. Luckily, he was near a house and could just run inside. Murley's goal in educating students is to make them feel safe and comfortable in nature. This, he says, will allow them to explore the outdoors and at the same time, themselves.
It's really not about wildness out there. It's about this wildness inside, not that savage connotation, right? But this wild being that's just like a bear, it's really capable of this graceful capacity for self-care. I'm hungry, I eat. I need to protect myself, I do it. I'm tired, I sleep. This sounds ludicrous to the construct in which most of us are moving in the modern world.
Murley says there are 1,000 stories out there turning bears into scary creatures, but most of them aren't true. Those stories, he says, are just about our own fear. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week on AK, we're heading to Palmer, home of the state's only musk ox farm.
It's Mark Austin. Well, living in Palmer is just the most beautiful place in the world as far as I'm concerned. It's surrounded by the Chugach and the Talkeetna Mountains. This property here is just beautiful rolling pastures with the muskoxen with the backdrop of the Chigach. It's pretty fantastic. Palmer's has one of those unique things about it that was developed at a time where they actually set up a real kind of a town grid, and I think that so much of Alaska is quite young. It grew up really quickly and didn't have some of the planning that gave it that really sense of a downtown and a main street that Palmer was able to get and hold on to. I think that makes Palmer pretty special in Alaska. Here at the muskox farm, we have been in the process of domesticating these muskoxen for about 50 years now. We're hoping to create a positive economic opportunity for people who do live in rural Alaska through the use of a geographically appropriate domesticate. The muskoxen produce we harvest their kiviut, their soft underwool, every year from them, and we will harvest between 4 and 9 pounds of kiviut per animal. It's one of the softest natural fibers that there are in the world. The people in Palmer are just an amazing crew. I think they're, you know, much like people all over Alaska, there's a frontier spirit or a willingness to, you know, you don't hear people complain about the weather a whole lot. People tend to kind of grin and bear it, and I think we're all in it together, and I think that's one of the things that really makes Alaska unique and Alaska. Boy, Palmer's a great community. The muskox farm is one of the most unique agriculture experience in mankind, known as domesticated a large animal in thousands of years, and we're actually trying to do it intentionally, and it's an amazing project, and it's right here in our backyard.
Mark Austin is director of the muskox farm in Palmer. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lisa Fu, Sean Carpenter, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Joaquin Palomino.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Gokey. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign, with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Stand Down event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.